We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Football Vision Podcast. I'm your host, Phil Costa, and a quick apology from my side. This podcast is going out a bit later than expected because I'm moving from Berlin to Barcelona tomorrow, and things have been stressful to say the least, but we're here with another episode, and thank you for making us part of your weekly routine. For this week's episode, we've got Amy Rushguy in the hot seat, who is the lead women's football writer at Goal, having covered women's football for the best part of 10 years, including a stint at her own club, Bradford City. Amy, welcome to the show. How's it going?
Good. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. I was just saying before, we've known each other for a while, actually, on Twitter without having managed to sit down together for a podcast. But I thought with the end of the season coming up, it would be the perfect time to round up what has been a busy, entertaining season in the women's game. I think it's safe to say. Just before we get into the show, tell us a bit about yourself, your journey into football, and what your experiences have been like, both as a fan and someone who has managed to force their way into journalism, which is notoriously difficult to do as a woman.
Yeah, so I used to play, not to a particularly high level or anything like that, but, you know, I used to play, I ended up playing at Bradford, which is where I'm from, it's my club, and I was doing a sports journalism degree at the same time as kind of moving into the sort of senior setup there, so started to lend a hand with some of the little bits, programs, websites, social media, write-ups in the local paper, all that kind of stuff that, you know, when you're working, when it's a club that's, you know, an amateur club, basically, you need those kind of people to pull that weight. So did bits and bobs with that as I was doing my degree. And then, just graduated, managed to land a job at Goal. Actually started doing social media initially, but was taking a stab at doing some features throughout the first kind of year I was there. And we didn't do a lot of women's football back then. We just didn't really, I guess, have somebody that had come in and wanted to do it. And, you know, I grew up watching men's football. That was always what I'd watched. You know, women's football wasn't really knocking around on the TV unless it was FA Cup final, really. And it was only because I'd come through at Bradford and, you know, covered them doing FA Cup and things like that, that I was like, oh, well, you know, it was 2018 when I started working at Goal, and it was building up to that 2019 World Cup. And I just kind of said, you know, are we doing anything this summer? Because there wasn't really that sort of main tournament that was going to steal all the limelight. I managed to talk my way into a flight to France and covered the tournament from there. And yeah, it just kind of built from there. We slowly phased out of doing the social media into doing women's football full time, to the point, yeah, done quite a few tournaments now and hopefully do quite a few more.
Yeah, you've done it really well. I think it's so difficult, as you know, especially as a woman, but also the football journalism industry is very competitive. There's not a lot of jobs going. I think there's been over the last 10 years, even in my experience, a lot of, oh, you can work for free and we'll give you some exposure, which, you know, exposure doesn't pay the bills, as a lot of creatives learn and understand. you're obviously the lead women's football writer now at Gold. Just a bit more on what that entails. What have you been doing? Do you go to games? Do you do features? What is your role, effectively?
Yeah, well, I guess we mainly focus on feature writing, but you know, a lot of that comes from games now. You know, I think in recent times, especially, we've seen you kind of have to adapt as you go in a way for an audience like Goals, for example, which is, you know, we've only, like I say, really started to fully commit to the women's game in the last sort of 5 years as a, you know, sending people out to cover it on a regular basis. And, you know, that's not particularly late for Goal. That's kind of like the whole industry sort of paying attention to it the last 5 years. But in that time, we've had to kind of modify our approach and, you know, what do the readers want to read? Like, you know, how can we bring new people to the audience and things like that? And it's just kind of figuring out what people want, you know, and the stories they want to hear, and what interests them. Just find out what interests them and then sort of stick to that. So, yeah, going out to games every week and kind of focusing on, you notice this now, I think, you know, growing up it was about the teams, you like certain teams. And I think nowadays with the audience, it's about players, you know. You think about people follow players rather than clubs almost in some instances. So you notice that there are certain players that make people tick. And yeah, it's just sort of delving into that and delving into the stories that people really want to read, but also giving them reason to read things that, you know, they might not click on that. You know, I know we'll get onto the next gen stuff later, but it's kind of like, you know, we do profiles every so often and it's like this Ciara Keating, for example, when she was coming through this season, this young, talented England goalkeeper that sort of usurped, you know, some really big names to be the number one there. And it's that kind of story that you're like, oh, somebody might want to click on that as opposed to just reading, you know, about Mary Earps and Ella Toon every day. So, yeah, it's finding that balance between those big names and telling stories. And, yeah, it involves going to games, you know, doing a lot of feature writing, doing a lot of transcribing and digging and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, just finding the right balance, basically, what the audience wants and what the audience kind of might want as well.
I think you've raised a really interesting point there. And I was going to ask you about that later, about players and how that sort of culture has completely gone the opposite way for women's football. Obviously, you have the Ronaldo-Messi wars in men's football, but it's very club-centric. So to see players kind of taking center stage now, I think is really interesting. In general, the women's game has enjoyed an incredible rise over the last decade, but even more so over the last 5 years, I would say, and you've been very well placed to see that happen. There have been record-breaking transfers, record-breaking attendances, global television viewing figures are at an all-time high. You are seeing, you know, real honest bonds being formed with players, with national teams and their fans as a result of their performances. Favorite players never feel far away, I think, in women's football is the way to describe it. They are accessible through social media, at games, and those barriers which seem so difficult to break down in the men's game don't really exist in women's football, which has led to this culture of buy-in and support. What I've always really liked and admired about women's football is their total openness, both towards fans and players in terms of sexual identification, orientation, race, political issues. There is no sense of needing to hide yourself or feeling uncomfortable in potentially difficult environments. And I think that has had a huge impact on recent growth as well, because people feel comfortable around the women's game, going to the game, supporting people. Even more recently, there's been a stronger focus on giving players the spotlight. There's been recognition at major events with the Ballon d'Or, the FIFA Best Awards. You know, even Mary Earps, who you mentioned before, was recently voted as BBC Sports Personality of the Year. You know, from your personal perspective, what has it been like to cover women's football now? And how does it differ to men's football in terms of, let's say, access, environment, attitude, and where do you see things going over the next few years?
Yeah, I mean, there's been some pretty remarkable moments. You know, I remember I did the Euros final at Wembley. I think even doing the England-Germany game at Wembley in 2019, there was like 77,000 there or something. And it was, I'd been to Wembley as a kid to watch England men, obviously, not the women back then. And, you know, it was kind of that moment of you couldn't really imagine this being a thing when I was a kid. You know, I didn't really watch any women's football until I was, you know, late teens, really, just because of the accessibility. So to see sort of 78,000 in there for a friendly, you know, the Euros final and stuff like that. But even abroad, like I did the Clásico, the Real Madrid-Barcelona Clásico, the Real Madrid-Barcelona-Wolfsburg games. You know, there's been a lot and a lot of growth kind of across the globe. And there are moments where you're kind of there and there are these big occasions in these big stadiums, you know, packed out. And there are the odd one where you think, God, this is quite remarkable, really, when you think about it. It is growing massively as well because, you know, even, you know, accessibility that you mentioned there, like that's going to start to not become a problem, but almost like, you know, the players are so packed in demand now that, you know, the sport is growing to a point where it's not just as easy to sort of get an interview as it was 5 years ago. And that's kind of part of the growth, of course. And, you know, even things like fans after games, you know, crowding around and wanting signed shirts, you know, that used to be, you know, a couple of hundred, now it's a few thousand. So there are probably going to be teething problems for it because it has just grown at such a ridiculous rate. Like it's gone from, you know, it must have grown like not even 50%, 100%, you're talking 1,000% that it's just jumped. So it'd be quite interesting to see how everything kind of evolves in that way with such a drastic jump. But, you know, it's fantastic because, you know, there's nothing worse. I remember as a kid growing up, football mad, there was nothing worse than a summer with no major tournament, right? You just sit around, you've got to go play football outside yourself. But you come in and there's nothing really on the TV. And, you know, by just having that, there'll be kids growing up that, you know, there might not be a men's tournament one summer, but there's a women's tournament and that's just the same. And I think that's kind of cool. That's just like, you know, you can see it going that way now where kids growing up, they just see it as football and they just love to watch football. And the fact that it's so much more visible now is so great for that.
That's the key, isn't it? And I think they've done a really amazing job in creating a sense of occasion. You know, North London derbies, for example, Arsenal and Tottenham are very heavily marketed and pushed by both the men's and the women's accounts. I think the Clásico, like you mentioned as well, has taken on a real sense of occasion in the women's game, not just the men's game. So it's all about increasing that visibility to people, getting people involved, making games and tickets accessible to people. And, you know, you've really seen it in England, especially, you know, filling Stamford Bridge, filling the Emirates Stadium, the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, giving them a chance to play in the men's arenas where you can get thousands of, you know, of people in to come and visit, maybe during an international break. It's all about eyeballs. It's all about accessibility. And recently, the Deloitte Football Money League predicted that women's elite sports will generate global revenues in excess of 1.1 billion euros this year, with football being the most valuable women's sport. I think that's starting to translate into transfer fees now, because before signing on a free transfer last summer, Arsenal offered Manchester United what would have been a then world record fee for Alessio Russo, thought to be just shy of 500,000 euro. £500,000, a figure that would have trumped the £400,000 that Barcelona paid to Manchester City for Kira Walsh. There's a very real prospect that we will see a landmark £1 million transfer in the next 12 to 18 months, maybe 2 years. Would you have predicted that 5 years ago? I mean, I don't think many would have. It's incredible to see now that transfers of this size and stature are becoming a more regular thing, because ultimately it can only be a good thing for the game when talent is costing money, and it's what the players deserve, and it's nice to create that sense of economy within the game as well.
Yeah, and I think it forces teams to invest as well. You know, teams can't just sort of, you know, half-arse it. They've got to really commit to it. And that's another thing, is what I mean about the sort of growth has been so quick. I mean, I think when Fran Kirby moved to Chelsea, was that 2015? She was like one of the most, she was Britain's most expensive player. That was like £20,000 or something. you know, it's, I can't remember the figure off the top of my head, but it's that kind of growth is just remarkable. And this is the thing, it's going to be quite interesting to see how people cope with that, like just on how rapid it is and how people keep up on certain levels. And but yeah, I think it does kind of tell clubs that if you want success, you can't just sort of, you know, not look after it properly, not invest properly. Like, and at the same rate, it's not a big sort of drop in the bucket for some clubs. You know, you think about the size of a club like Real Madrid, for example, and the finances that clubs like that have. And, you know, you put a small portion of that into your women's team and you can have one of the most successful women's teams around. And so, you know, I always think it's quite strange really when clubs don't commit to the women's teams, because I just think it's not that much money kind of off your bill, and it's an easy PR win at the end of the day. Like, why would you not want another team of your club winning? And I think that attitude is starting to translate, and a lot of people are realizing the value and the success that can come from women's football now. And yeah, like you said, to have the players kind of getting what they deserve is a really good thing to see.
Yeah, I think clubs like Lyon, for example, Arsenal, were always very keen and open to put funding into their women's teams. But a lot of people won't even know that Manchester United didn't even have a women's team until very recently. And you think, it's just, how can this even happen for a club of that stature? You know, it just seems like the easiest thing to do and to organize. They're probably, next to Real Madrid, one of the most commercially global clubs with sponsorships and commercial deals. It would just be an absolute drop in the ocean. Yet you're only starting to see it happen now with proper funding and allocating proper resources to their women's team. So completely agreed on that front. Just looking beyond the growth of the game, all the money that's coming in, maybe focusing on this season a bit. Obviously, so much has happened and could still happen as we wrap up towards the end of the season. But I'd like to do a quick overview of, first of all, of English football and cover any major stories from across Europe afterwards. You know, really anything of note that our listeners might not know about. I think the obvious one in the WSL is the departure of Emma Hayes, who's leaving Chelsea after 11 years in charge to pursue new opportunities in the United States. It looks like she will be leaving without a seventh league title after they lost to Liverpool yesterday. Manchester City are pulling clear. Just quickly on Emma Hayes, what effect will that have on the WSL? And how does she rank in terms of overall influence on the women on the women's game? She's been a pioneer. And I think whether you like her or you don't like her, she can be quite spiky at times. You can't deny the influence that she's had on not only Chelsea, but the women's game in general in England.
Yeah, you notice how big a figure and how well recognised she is when you dip into an Emma Hayes presser. And, you know, she's kind of used as a talking head sometimes. Like, people want to know her opinion on, you know, anything and everything, you know, for a news line and things like that, because everybody knows who she is and everybody knows the status she has at the top of the game and things like that. And I'm quite interested to see, actually, when she does leave to take charge of the US, sort of how, you know, that might drive further interest, just that interest of her being the US manager. You know, here in England, people that normally might not follow, you know, what's going on beyond England's national team might sort of turn the head and be keeping an eye on and just keeping track of stories from elsewhere. I think it'd be quite interesting to see how the interest changes. But yeah, the impact that she's had on the game is massive. I think as well, it's a remarkable what her and Chelsea have done together to invest in a coach, to work together, to take the steps forward that they have. I mean, when she took over in 2012, they finished, I think it was third from bottom in the WSL, and, you know, they won all of the last four titles in the league. You know, they've reached the Champions League final. They've won three FA Cups in a row. They've basically gone from nowhere to top of the tree. And, you know, and that's what we're talking about, the commitment. If a club can commit to the women's project, that's kind of what you can get. And yeah, she's done a remarkable job, and really interested to see how she gets on in international football as well.
Have you had to deal with her personally before? What's she like in press conferences or in the mix zone? Is she quite an entertaining person to get a line from?
Yeah, she's speaking to her last night. I was at the Liverpool game last night, and you know, she's always great to kind of speak to and goes into a lot of detail about certain things and is quite interesting, obviously quite humorous. She's always backs her players. You know, I think she's, yeah, just a, she comes across really well and, yeah, always been kind of a pleasure, certainly for me to deal with her while I've been doing this job.
I think when managers and coaches are here for such a long time, it's always quite strange to imagine a Chelsea without Emma Hayes, for example, just like it was with Sir Alex Ferguson at Manchester United and even Arsene Wenger at Arsenal. I think there is a period of transition coming for Chelsea where it might get worse before it gets good, purely because, you know, someone being in charge for so long with their ways and their methods and their practices can kind of feel ingrained in the club almost. So for everybody, there's a lot of change ready to come. Go on.
Yeah, I was just going to say it'd be quite interesting to see, because they have such a squad, such a talented squad, how they kind of move on. Because, you know, you'd like to think, you know, somebody in the pub would say, oh, well, if you put me in charge of that team, like, I'd win as well. Like, look how good that team is. But, you know, you think that some of the talent that, and the squad building that she's done and the club's done, and you look at, they're bringing a lot of young players recently. If you look at Michael Hermano's come in, they've got a couple of young players that they've signed and loaned back out to their, you know, previous clubs this current season that will join in the summer. They've been looking at moving forward. So I think they're well set up and well placed for somebody to come in and do well, but it'll still be a really tough act to follow.
No doubt. And looking at the WSL more broadly, have there been any standout players who have impressed you, or even on the technical side as a manager? Has anyone made a major impact? I think it would be it would be a huge collapse, let's be honest, if City don't win the league at this point. They're, I think, the best team in the country. I think they've had the best players. I know they've got Bunny Shaw injured now for the rest of the season, which is a major blow, but I think they should be able to just about get over the line. Any other narratives or stories that people might be interested in knowing?
I think the Kiara Keating one this season has been quite exciting to watch. You know, this really good young goalkeeper at City who's come in and just kind of assumed the number one shirt from the get-go. And we'd seen a little bit of her the last few seasons, kind of just thrown in sporadically. You know, the cup game here, you know, maybe a league game here, and always looked quite talented, but yeah, she's been given kind of a platform to flourish this season. She's really from that next generation of goalkeepers, right? That kind that you can throw in midfield and they play well. She's quite diminutive with her size, but, you know, really springs up and commands her area, collects the ball and things like that. And been a few errors and a few mistakes this season here and there, which, you know, she's still only 18, maybe 19 now, to be expected, but looks like a really, really talented, and, you know, sometimes you don't really see a goalkeeper is quite exciting to watch, but she is in a way, which is a little bit weird. I think away from City, the main two in the WSL that really impressed me is Liverpool and Spurs, really. It can be quite hard to come out of that middle pack in the WSL and push on and, you know, kind of go upper, you know, top half of the table. Matt Beard at Liverpool's done a really good job of, they got promoted and last season was their first back in the WSL. They had a steady season, you know, survived and had a really, really good transfer window. They've got Mia Enderby there, who was really good last night. I'll probably talk about her later when we talk about young players, but, you know, 18-year-old, really quick English forward who was causing Millie Bright all sorts of problems last night. And they've added lots of players like that. And, you know, they could finish fourth, you know, if they get a result against United at the weekend. And then, yeah, Spurs, you know, again, young players, exciting manager that's come in, and just sort of spicing things up. You know, we talk in the WSL, we've had a big three for a long time, and United have kind of come in and competing to make it a big four. But, you know, it'd be nice to see teams from a bit lower down sort to come up and upset the apple cart, if you will. You know, you look at like Aston Villa this season in the Premier League, you know, teams like Brighton, those kind of teams that are not your traditional big three, big four, whatever you want to call it, that just add a bit of spice. I think that's just great as a neutral to see these new and exciting projects come up.
Just coming over to Germany, you know, Bayern Munich unbeaten in the league, Wolfsburg, their kind of main title rivals, not quite able to match their pace with any real intent. It's good news for Georgia Stanway, at least, who now has two Bundesliga, Frauen Bundesliga titles in 2 years. I just wanted to touch on this league in particular, because another huge story is Lena Oberdorf leaving Wolfsburg to join Bayern Munich. What's happened there? How has this happened? And it feels very reminiscent of how Bayern Munich used to take Robert Lewandowski or Mario Götze or, you know, whoever else has been there, Mats Hummels from Borussia Dortmund. This is supposed to be a main title rival competing every season for the biggest, you know, the biggest award in football. And they've just pinched their best player. What's happened there?
Yeah, I think we're seeing a bit of a change in the guard, really, in Germany. I remember speaking, I did a piece on Bayern Munich a few years ago when they were still kind of trying to establish themselves as the top team in Germany, and that was very much the aim. You know, they were doing well in the Champions League, but they were like, you know, the aim is not be champions of Europe right now. First of all, we need to be, you know, the champions of Germany and on a regular basis. And Wolfsburg, one of those teams that have historically done really well in women's football, probably not, a bit like Lyon, really, in terms of not being the biggest club possibly when you think about men's football in that country, but committed to women's football and really reaped the rewards, two-time European champions. But yeah, I think it's kind of almost like a sign of where women's football might be going. Because as the money comes in, you're going to get those big teams sort of rising to the top, the big clubs that you historically associate with being big in that country, rather than, you know, Wolfsburg or, you know, in England, seeing teams like, you know, Birmingham, who were always up there, they're, you know, down in the second tier now, teams like that. So I think Bayern Munich have really stepped up their attempt recently. You know, you look at the Pernille Harder signing, that was another really big one. The Lena Oberdorf one. There's been quite a few recently where they've really kind of shown, no, we're really here to be the dominant team in Germany. And Wolfsburg's model is a bit more about signing young players and developing them. And, you know, there's been a couple of misses really recently with Wolfsburg in doing that. So it's a contrast in probably strategies. I mean, Bayern Munich's still very good at developing players as well, but Wolfsburg are now having to compete with that big financial might that they don't have, and it might lead to a bit of a changing of the guard, really. I'm quite interested to see how that develops over the next few seasons.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and I think Oberdorf as a player is very valuable because she can play at centre-back. She's also played in midfield, you know, a big physical presence in the side. And I think about her and Georgia Stanway in the same kind of area in the pitch, and that's a very strong spine. So that will be one to watch as well. Just quickly switching over to Spain. Look, naturally, Barcelona are head and shoulders above everybody in this league. Even their closest competitors, Real Madrid, are 12 points behind with 5 games to play. So they're also unbeaten, Barcelona. So just like Bayern, also unbeaten. Just on a more national level, this question diverts slightly from the league itself. But after the awful events from last summer's World Cup involving Jenni Hermoso, Luis Rubiales, and the whole, even the Spanish national team on a wider scale, with so many players staying at home, and then obviously they won the World Cup afterwards. What has the kind of reaction been like in the country? I know it's very easy for kind of hangovers to happen from these kind of incidents. There's even been a bit of a culture war at times that seems to have developed in the aftermath of this situation regarding, you know, a lot of social issues, consent. There's a lot of feeling that this kind of machismo culture still exists in Spain. Has sport in general and football taken on this carried on to kind of prove these people wrong, or has it just kind of been business as usual?
Yeah, well, I think Bonmatí said a couple of times, I tell Bonmatí, the Spain star, a couple of times this season that, you know, nothing's really changed since the World Cup, which is kind of difficult for those players that, you know, they might be quite frustrated with the progress that's been made in their own country, but, you know, they're proud to represent their own country. And, you know, certainly in a lot of players' cases, you know, they want to stay and play for a team like Barcelona, right? So you kind of find yourself stuck a little bit. I think as well, it's that thing of wanting to stay in and sort of lead the way and try and be that role model and try and be one of those people at the forefront to push change. And, you know, the more that we're here and the more that we do and the more that we speak out about things like that, you know, can this generate change? And I think, you know, it is really good to see the players that are talking out about it. And trying to, not just in interviews in Spain, but interviews, you know, with global media, with, you know, media in different countries, to kind of just get the message across that that things still need to change. That, you know, they might have won the World Cup, they might have won the Nations League, they could go and win gold at the Olympics this summer, but it is still kind of giving that message of they're still not seeing the progress that they want. And I think it's really important that they continue to kind of give that message, because, you know, that's the only way that, that change is going to happen, is if you constantly kind of point to the fact that, you know, things still need to get better. And, you know, absolutely fair play to them for doing that, because, you know, a lot of people would shy away from that.
Yeah, it's kind of what you said about being stuck, because you want to be kind of this person that pushes for change and awareness, but also your career is something that you've put years and you know, hours into, blood, sweat and tears. So I think the reaction itself at that moment, even in the aftermath of the World Cup win, was super important, but completely agreed. It's all about maintaining that now. And to be honest, I think in terms of Spain, they still need more support from above. I think there are major issues in Spanish football, both in the men's and women's side. We've seen it this season already in La Liga with the racism that Vinicius Jr. has had to face and things like that. There are big issues. So fingers crossed that people can continue pushing for change. And I think that's the perfect time to kind of take a break for part one. And we'll come back for part two to discuss the UWCL and some young players to watch. So join us then.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to part two, and we'll be discussing the Women's Champions League, the UWCL now. It's the biggest game in the football calendar, and unsurprisingly, Lyon and Barcelona are Champions League finalists, both of whom have significant pedigree already in the competition. Both are unbeaten domestically this season, and I don't think it's a stretch to say that these are probably the two best teams in Europe at the moment. Maybe with City there or thereabouts, as well as Bayern Munich. Before we dive into the finalists, were there any narratives throughout the season's competition that you enjoyed seeing play out, or shocks that you weren't expecting? I know the emergence of Paris FC, who had some incredible results. I mean, they knocked out Arsenal in the playoffs. They beat Real Madrid home and away. They kind of became these cult heroes in a way, and really embraced the underdog tag. So yeah, just throughout your coverage this season, have there been any stories or narratives that you've enjoyed following?
Yeah, I really enjoyed watching Ajax this season, actually. They were in the group stages for the first time, and they managed to get out of a group that had Roma, the Italian champions, Bayern Munich, German champions, and PSG. And, you know, they came through, and I think it's such an exciting sort of emergence. They're one of those teams that, you know, everybody knows Ajax, and they're one of those teams that you kind of get excited to watch. So I think I remember doing a piece on them a couple of years ago because they played Arsenal in a qualifier, and they were only lost out narrowly in that qualifier, and they've kicked on in the time since, and they bring young players through, they try and play good football, and they were really good to watch, and I thought they gave Chelsea a really good game in the second leg of their quarterfinal. I think as well, another quarterfinalist was Häcken from Sweden, and they've got a really good young talent in there called Rosa Kafaji, and she really lit up the Champions League whenever I watched her this season, and just really enjoyed watching her and watching some of those sort of surprise packages come through. You know, you mentioned Paris FC as well, and just getting some upsets and some different names, and the quarterfinals, when they came out, they were all quite on paper. You looked at them, they were all sort of like you could pick which team was going to win, but they ended up all being really entertaining. And I think that's really important for the competition, not to just have, you know, teams getting trounced 8-0 and stuff like that. Like to have these really close and entertaining games, it just kind of shows that the growth is really far and wide in Europe.
I think it's, you kind of alluded to that earlier in the WSL, maybe with teams cracking the top level. And now we've seen it in this season's Champions League. You mentioned Häcken as well. Brann, I think, had a really good group stage. Even teams like Eintracht Frankfurt were pulling their weight in the group stages. And for me, this has been a real positive of the women's game in the last couple of years, because the level seems to be equalizing a bit, because so often it was, like you said, Chelsea would go away to X team, win 5-0 without breaking a sweat, and then they can come back to their domestic game. But now there's an actual feeling of competition in the Champions League, which I think is so important, because this is what it should be, you know? And yes, of course, Lyon trounced their group. I mean, 25 goals scored, only 5 conceded. Barcelona the same, unbeaten. There will obviously always be those teams, but it's been a real positive this season to kind of see those teams come through. Just to touch on the final, of course, Lyon and Barcelona. We spoke about their pedigree in the competition before. Lyon have featured in 7 of the last 9 finals. They've won this competition more than any other club. They've won it 8 times since 2011 and are obviously very well placed to do so again under Sonia Bonpastor, who's also been linked with Chelsea, I think, if I'm not mistaken. So that could be one to watch, maybe the final farewell with another Champions League glory. They score loads of goals, they barely concede any, and they have a really nice blend of youth and experience in the squad. You know, Selma Basha is at left back, is a favourite of mine. I really enjoy how she plays, but you look throughout the team and it's completely stacked, from Wendy Renard to Khadija Tugiani as well. There's just so much talent there. Just give me a bit of a deep dive on Lyon and how they play, who could be the game changers, how they will be, what kind of shape they're going into this game.
Yeah, well, I think they'll be quite happy to let Barcelona kind of control and dictate, and they'll just, you know, look to catch them on the counter in transition, you know, set pieces, things like that. And, you know, that sounds, you know, that might sound kind of derogatory to them. It might sound like, you know, they're not a proper good team that can take a game to anybody, but they definitely could if they wanted to. And they definitely did in the last time these two met in the final. They were 3-0 up, 3-0 up before half time. And it's just one of those where you've got to try and figure out, with Barca, do you fight fire with fire, or do you let them? Look, if you want to have the ball, you have the ball. We know, because Lyon know they've got players that can hurt them on the counter, and I think that's probably where they'll find their joy. Quick wingers, the support of like Samuel Basha, like you mentioned there, Eli Carpenter on the other wing from fullback, that kind of real running power and, you know, real talent in the final third can be absolutely devastating. And it's a really good matchup in that sense, in terms of the tactical battle, because it's kind of opposites in a way. Even if, like I say, Lyon can get their foot on the ball and really dominate with the players they have, I think they'd be happy to take their chances on the counter here. And that's going to be it's going to be so interesting. I've been really impressed with Melchior De Mornay in the last stages of this tournament, actually. 20-year-old, I think she is now. Haitian international, real rising star, you know, one of the best young players in the world. And it's her first season at Lyon. She scored in both legs in the semi-finals against PSG. And, you know, it's just a reminder that, yes, they have all these really established names that you know, but they also have some really, really talented young players coming through. And like you say, when you look through that squad, it's just a lot of talent that can hurt you, that's for sure.
Barcelona don't quite have the same history as Lyon in the competition, but they've been a very recent force. You know, they've won it twice in 2021 and 2023, finished as runners-up in 2019 and 2022. So look, they know where they stand and how to navigate these kind of games. We spoke about Lyon having talent, but Barcelona's squad just feels almost unfair compared to that. I mean, they're so rounded and complete in every position. Aitana Bonmatí is just absolutely magic. Alexia Putellas, Ballon d'Or winner, huge influence in the middle of the park, even further forward. Kira Walsh, Carolina, Graham Hansen, Ona Batié. I mean, every position, there's like world-class quality in there. And I think it will obviously be a close game between two strong, evenly matched sides. My instincts take me towards Barcelona. If I had to push you for an answer now, who would you go with? I mean, let's look at the game as a game, as a match. Where might this game be won and lost? Are you backing any specific players to make a difference, or could there be like an interesting tactical side of things to look out for? But yeah, I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you for a winner here.
Well, when they played in the 2022 final, I'd watched, you know, a lot of both teams in the build-up to that final. And in my head, I was like, you know, I think Barcelona will win it. You know, they're a better team, I thought. And, you know, I felt quite confident about saying that. And then I did a piece with some of the Lyon players before the game. And just speaking to them, I spoke to Caterina Macario. I spoke to Damaris Agarola. And I think that might have been it. I might have spoken to somebody else. And just the, like, ice-cold mentality that they had. I remember speaking to them, and I feel like I suddenly changed my mind. I was like, no, I think Lyon are going to win this game. Because they were just, you know, they're kind of built like that. It's quite incredible how steely they are. And that is what I'm quite interested in, because the two finals that Barcelona have lost, they lost them both to Lyon. I think Lyon have that sort of psychological edge over them. And I know Barcelona, they've spoken this season about that mentality and trying to improve that mentality. So that's going to be, for me, you know, for all the tactical stuff, which I think is really interesting as well, that's going to be really interesting. If Barcelona concede early, like they did last time they met in the final, how do they respond? Do they suddenly descend into 3-0 down, or are they back 1-1 and it's level pegging again? Like, that's going to be such an interesting sort of narrative to follow, because it is sort of some almost like new money against old money. You know, Lyon are the 8-time champions, and I think going into that 2022 final, they were a lot of like, don't forget about us. Everybody's talking about Barcelona, but don't forget about us. We've been here a long time. And they do have that little bit of a chip on their shoulder. And that's what makes this even more interesting, I think.
It's, you know, this is the game that everybody will be watching. It's a kind of Lyon at maybe the end of their journey with Bon Pastor. Barcelona are kind of, like you said, the new team coming through, looking to dominate everything. Yeah, my instincts take me towards Barca, but look, in these kind of games, experience can often be the difference maker. So maybe that can work in the favor of Lyon. Just to finish, for those who don't know, Goal produce their next gen list every season, which features 50 of the most exciting talents in men's football and 25 of the most exciting teenage talents in the women's game. And luckily for us, Amy, you wrote this season's list, and also I think what the previous five editions in the women's side. So it's fair to say that you've got an eye for talent. And something I noticed, which also does a great job of showing just how much the women's game has improved and how much it's grown, was that the 2020 and 2021 editions of Next Gen only featured 10 players from the women's game before jumping to 20 in 2022. And now you're writing about 25 players, which obviously came into effect in 2023. So there is plenty of ability coming through. And while there has been a greater general interest in women's football, the quality of player coming through has also made a big difference. It's bringing eyeballs to the game. There's a high level of coaching. These players are being, or pathways for these players are much easier to find, you know, and talent is a lot more expected as opposed to just looking in England or just looking in France. You can find talent in Haiti, like you said. You can find it in these more obscure nations, like obviously Linda Caicedo as well, who's been one of the most exciting young players. She's from Colombia. Oh my God, Colombia. Sorry, I thought of Moises Caicedo, and I was like, oh God, she might be Ecuadorian. So there's talent in so many parts of this world. So naturally, I'm going to put you on the spot and ask for your opinion on some players coming through at the moment. I've got a couple of names as well that I've enjoyed watching over the last couple of years. I think Salma Parueyo in Barcelona has been a favorite of mine, especially after her performances at the World Cup last summer. You know, she's only improved this season. Her output has been so good in the league and in the Champions League. She's super direct, can play on both sides, searing pace, but she's got, you know, very technical, high level of technical quality, sorry. And, you know, she's even earned the nickname Usain Bolt from her teammates because of her prominent athletics background. I'm also really excited about Catherine Kuhl. Obviously slightly biased, of course. I'm an Arsenal fan. But she looks like the perfect two-way midfielder with great offensive potential, the ability to play through the lines, can carry the ball as well. And already she's being tipped to captain Denmark in the future. Is there anyone that has caught your eye during your coverage of this season, or is there someone bubbling under the surface that we don't know about yet that we should be looking out for in the future?
Yeah, I think Demoni, as I mentioned earlier, would definitely be one. I think, you know, it's her first season at Lyon, and to step up in the manner she has, particularly in the Champions League, has been really impressive. You know, I've been following her sort of progress for quite a few years now, and just to see her constantly reach new levels is so exciting, especially when she's playing for a club like that. I think on the other side in that Champions League final is Vicky Lopez, who plays for Barcelona, who's just... Everything about her screams sort of, you know, you hate to put this on them so young, but screams future Ballon d'Or winner. Like, one of the most talented players of her age, you know, and one of the most talented players in, probably in the world, just in terms of actual raw talent already, despite being a teenager. And the way that she's been able to come into a Barcelona team and impact it, so, you know, speaks to how high her level is and how bright her future is. There's a few bubbling under, I think. At Chelsea, probably a more prominent one this season has been Aggie Beaver-Jones. I think she's 20 years old now, but had a couple of loan spells, one in the Championship, one in the WSL, and has come back into that team this season and really taken her chances, made an impact, scored a lot of goals. You know, watched her score two last night. She was unlucky not to get a hat-trick. Like, just one of those really exciting players. And yeah, I think there's always ones bubbling under. I mean, in Germany, Mara Alba at Hoffenheim has really caught my eye this season. She's really driving them forward and I think it's still her first full senior season as a teenager, and they could get a Champions League spot. And then we speak about obscure nations. One player that I've really kind of caught my eye over the last couple of seasons is at Roma. They got a young midfielder by the name of Zara Kramzar, who's from Slovenia. They actually picked her up when she was 16 from the Slovenian league, and she's quite sort of physical, but also, like, she, you know, she's got a lot of big athletic traits, but she's also really technical, which I always think is quite an exciting sort of blend. So I've been interested to see how she gets on, but there's just, I think with the development of the game and the investment of it, these young kids coming through, when they come through, you think, like, they can do things that you've not really seen many players do before. And some of the older players talk about that. They're like, you know, that kid can do things that I couldn't do at that age, just because that development and that investment and the way they come through is, you know, in a much better place in terms of resources and the commitment to their development from the club. So I think, you know, it looks like the level's just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. Like, and that's really exciting.
I was going to ask you, actually, because I think as the quality of coaching improves, as the standard of players improves over time, could there be a next gen edition with 50 women's players in future?
Yeah, I think one of the main kind of blockers for that at the moment is sort of visibility as well. So, you know, when my colleagues do the men's list, they're able to watch, you know, thousands of players that are probably on a short list for them or a long list. Whereas you can hear about certain players, and or there might be players that just sort of come out of nowhere and you've never seen much about them before because, you know, how are you watching? For example, if we look at Africa, which is one of the most sort of untapped continents for potential, you know, in men's and women's football, you know, you're not watching sort of the regional competitions between national teams at under 17 level and things like that. Like, you might get the, even things like the South American Championships can be difficult to watch and things like that. So it is just about, you know, in terms of doing my job and compiling the list, it's kind of visibility is quite a big thing, and accessibility. So I think as that continues to improve, which it has, and that's kind of allowed us to grow from 10 to 20 to 25, as that all grows, it makes the job a lot easier in terms of not thinking that you're taking a punt by putting a player in. You know, you want to be sure that when you put a player in that they are good and you're not just doing it for fun, right? That's what the job is. So I think as everything increases, we definitely increase. I mean, we're already at a point now. When I was working with a couple of colleagues to put the list together for this year, I was like, I can't narrow it to 25. Like, I need more. But yeah, I think with steady growth and with that increase in accessibility and just sort of, the visibility of the leagues, it's, there's so much talent out there. And once we get to see it a little bit more, then yeah, we'll definitely have a 50 a year sooner rather than later.
Looking forward to it. I mean, especially with international tournaments, you get the occasional player who just, you know, one has a breakout tournament or a World Cup or a Euros, and all of a sudden that's all they need, and then they get a move to a bigger club in Europe, and that's how you forge your career. So super, super interesting. I think a very clear topic from the episode today was visibility, accessibility. You know, this is so important in sport, and like you said, we didn't really have this option growing up for women's football, especially. So I think now, whether you're a boy or a girl or however you identify, having these games on TV, having these international tournaments on TV to watch, to follow, having tickets at an affordable price to go to games, it will make such a big difference in not only the visibility of sport, but also for young players coming through, because they can watch men and women's football equally. So and ultimately, that's all anybody wants, isn't it? Just equality. So thanks so much for your time. I've really enjoyed it. I think this is even now you spoke about outlets and newspapers starting to wake up to women's football, but I think there's still a long way to go. And you know, I can't pretend to know everything myself, but even from following you, I've learned so much. And you know, I know you're busy. So thanks so much for your time. If anyone still uses Twitter, you can find Amy at Amy Rushkai, and as mentioned previously, at Goal. But I'm sure you'll be doing some other bits and pieces as well in future. I'll link obviously all your socials in at the bottom. Thanks so much for coming on, Amy.
No, thank you for having me.
And that's all for today. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Football Vision Podcast. I hope you all enjoyed it, and we'll be back next week with another show. Cheers.